Numbers chapter 27. Well, here in verse 14, God reminds Moses that he's not going to enter the land because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin, in the strife of the congregation to sanctify me at the waters before their eyes. You, Moses, are not going in because you rebelled against my word. And, of course, Moses sort of accepted that, and yet you can sense that he does cavil against it. When he talks to Israel about why he's not going into the land, he repeatedly says, God was angry with me for your sakes. He sort of puts the blame upon them. Now, I think that it's typical of all of us not wanting to face up to the consequence of sin. You can understand why Moses fell into that temptation, because he was very meek. We're told that in Numbers 12. He was the meekest man on earth. His failure in cranking away at them and saying, you rebels, must we get you water out of this rock? And he strikes the rock instead of speaking to it. It was uncharacteristic, absolutely atypical behavior. And you could say, well, it seems a bit tough of God to judge a good, humble, obedient man for just one flash of weakness, just one flash of crankiness. And I think Moses does, as I say, cavil against it. He feels it's a bit unjust, and that's why he asks God to change his mind about this matter, but God won't. And it's why also, as I say, he says so many times, God was angry with me for your sakes. So he was weak on that point. And yet, God in a wonderful way worked through it. When Moses, I think, was at his finest in Exodus 32, when he's up the mountain, God says, I'm going to destroy Israel and make of you, Moses, a greater nation. Moses says, don't do that. And he persuades God not to. A huge achievement when God basically says, leave me alone, Moses, so that I may destroy them, because I know you'll persuade me, you're so persuasive to me. Very, very intimate relationship between God and man. And Moses says, well, let them go in and take me out of the book that you've written. Taking him out of the book that was written, I think, is tantamount to saying, may I not go into the land, but may they go in. Because in Ezekiel there's a passage that talks about all those that are written in the book shall enter into the land of Israel. So I think he's basically saying, okay, let them in and I won't go in. And God says, well, I don't quite work on that basis, Moses, because I deal not on the basis of substitution, of you substituting your salvation for theirs, but rather on the basis of you being their representative. And yet, in a funny way, through Moses' failure, and he doesn't enter the land, and yet they do, at least their children do, for the most part. You see then how God, in a way, heard the essence of what Moses was asking and what Moses was saying, even though the mechanics, as it were, of the answer, it depended upon Moses' own sin and weakness. So it's wonderful how God works with sin in this extremely complicated way. And we only see, you know, a few aspects of this. There's loads more aspects, I'm sure, that are hidden from our eyes. This is how complex is God's working with man. And this is going on all the time. Not simply in arranging things in the nations and arranging things in our own lives, by providence, by his hand, etc., but in a moral sense, so that his justice is upheld and nobody is forced, nobody is manipulated, etc. Human free will is respected, and yet also this sort of divine sovereignty, God's grace, his ability to act by grace in a sort of sovereign way, that is also enabled despite the uttermost respect of human free will. Well, Moses then rebelled, verse 14, you, Moses, rebelled against my word. Sure, he hit the rock instead of speaking to it. And you could argue that that was sort of crucifying Christ afresh, because that rock represented Christ, we're told, 1 Corinthians. and to strike the rock was like the striking of Jesus. But what does Moses say to the people? Must we bring you rebels water out of the rock? And God says to Moses, you were the rebel. This is my point. Israel were rebels. Many times he says to them in Deuteronomy, you rebelled against his word. And he says to them, must we bring you rebels water out of the rock? And God says, you, Moses, rebelled. You are a rebel. You see the danger of condemning others and assuming that we are not part of that. This is the whole difficulty, isn't it? As soon as you call someone else a rebel, this is what happened with Moses, you are rebelling. Paul is very clear about this in Romans. Who are you who judge, O man? Who are you who condemn others when you yourself are under condemnation? And so this is a powerful warning, is it not? Because it is a natural feature of human nature to want to condemn others, to want to criticize others. This is absolutely natural. And delving a little bit deeper, you ask, well, why is this? Why is this that we so want to judge, we so want to condemn, we so want to criticize? Why is it that we can see the failures of others so much clearer than we can ourselves? Why? Well, there is in psychology the idea of transference. And this is depth psychology. This is talking on the level of the absolute unconscious that is so deep in the subconscious that it is not consciously, we're not consciously aware of it. The idea is that you transfer onto others yourself and your own sins and your own weaknesses, and you judge them very severely for those things. You take the classic case. The pastor is having an affair, blows up a huge deal about some guy in the church who's having an affair. And he says, no, this is awful. Don't you realize how bad this is? You must be shamed in front of everybody. You must be disfellowshipped from the church. And then later it turns out the pastor himself was having an affair, and everyone's like, wow, what a hypocrite. How could he do that? Well, you don't need to be so shocked as to how could he do that once you understand this idea of transference. That actually what is happening is that in his deep subconscious, he knows that he's having an affair and he should be judged and sort of defrocked or whatever. And so he puts that onto another person and takes out all the condemnation and all the judgment that he feels he deserves on that other person. This can go even deeper, whereby a person, let's say the pastor is having the affair, might actually accuse some bloke who's not having an affair of having an affair. Oh, yep, I saw you this, I saw that, we've got evidence. And the poor guy's like, what? This is a total setup. What on earth did you just accuse me of this for? Wreck my life and chuck me out of your church on the basis of total false accusation. Because the guy who's doing it, who's making the false accusation, has actually got this going on in his own life. And yet he feels the need to judge it because he feels that he's under judgment. So he transfers himself onto you or whoever he happens to pick on and then pours judgment upon you. Now, as I say, until you realize that, you're then left scratching your head thinking, wow, how could the bloke do that? How could that pastor do that? Wow, that is unbelievable. That hypocrisy is unbelievable. No, it's not unbelievable. It's actually fairly normal once you perceive the psychology and the few of the processes that are going on. And I think that that's what you see here with Moses. You rebels, must I get you water out of the rock? Bang, Moses, you are the rebel. And this is what God says here in verse 14. You rebelled, therefore you are not entering the land, because you were the rebel. The minute he shouted at those people, you rebels, bang, you are the rebel. You see the same, David in the business of Bathsheba. Nathan comes to him, puts a parable to him about a rich man who's spared to take one of his own animals to entertain a visitor, but instead took the only lamb that belonged to a poor man. And David's incensed, kill the man. well, you know, he's going to be really badly judged for this. Nathan says, and you are the man. Why was David so incensed? Because subconsciously he knew that he was the man and that he deserved judgment, and so he wishes eagerly to pour out judgment upon this imaginary person who'd stolen a poor man's lamb. And so you see it in life, and so you see it in biblical history. It's all there for our learning. I mean, you don't need to read books about depth psychology. You could actually get it all from the history in the Bible. It's wonderful, biblical history. People who say it's boring haven't really read it and thought about it. These bits of history, these various comments that you have, this reveals all these processes to us.